Thanks, Clem. And wanted to also thank Phyllis in support of Kellogg. It was a useful process for us, and I'll spend some time telling you why. We got a boatload of slides to roll through. I thank all of you for either taking an early lunch, foregoing your lunch, or chatting and chewing with us here today, which is cool, too. I wanted to start off by saying that it's in my sincere hope you know that Clem has the coolest business card there is because it says futurist on it. And so I want him to sort of knight me after this presentation as futurist in training, and so I can add that to my business card.
Good.
That's
good.
My hope. That's my aspiration.
Good.
So what I would also say, too, is that I want to tell you a brief story about thinking about things differently. So I grew up in Cleveland, which is where Cuyahoga County is, on the west side of Cleveland, in a very small house with six brothers and sisters and one bathroom. One sister who was very tough, very, very tough, and five boys. And so in that process, occasionally a relative would have the guts to have us over for a holiday because we were sort of like ants on an apple core when we all went in. We were close in age, and we were all over the house, and my parents were fearful that we'd break things and, you know, spill things on the carpet, and such as we do as kids. And so we would try to occasionally visit people when they had the nerve to have us over. And so I remember one day we were heading to an uncle's house, and my mother would line us up when we were very young in front of the bathroom, sort of military style, and we would walk into the bathroom, and she would hold our face, and she would wash our face, and then wet the comb, and then comb our hair, and then say, "Sit on the couch." Because if we didn't sit on the couch, we'd be a holy mess, and we'd, of course, be back in line again, and that would be, you know, that would take too much time and the like. And so this went on many years, you know, the routine of the wash the face, comb the hair, is until we got older, of course. And so many years passed, and my brother Pat, who was, I think, fourth in line of us, we were preparing to go to an aunt's house, and Pat must have been maybe 13 or 14. And we walked by our living room, and we had sort of a mirror on the back of a closet. And there was Pat in front of the mirror holding his face like this, combing his hair. So his impression was is that that was the only way. Maybe he thought his head would fall off his neck. I don't know. But that was the way he thought business needed to be done. But, of course, we know that it works whether you hold your face or not, right? And so in the process, I think what I learned out of this work is that an opportunity to think about, to take some time to really think about things differently. Many of us may have moments in time, as busy as we are, remember what we had for breakfast, let alone thinking about planning ahead beyond a 3 to 5 year strategic plan. The context that I will give to you in non-futurist language, as I'm learning about the scenarios and the projections that Trevor and Clem provided to us when they visited with us, because they built in some scenarios that would be interesting to certainly consider. But it was very new to us, so I thought about it in terms of continuity operations, that work that we do around preparedness planning. How many are local public health here? Are there any folks from local public health? So quite a few. And so if you think about continuity of operations planning, we try to project what happens in an emergency if your building is non-functional, or if you lost power, you had to set up offices somewhere else, integrate IT systems, continue to track reportable diseases, dealing with records and the like, and a whole range of things that become pertinent that you need to stop and think about. How do you plan? And if you needed to have another building, you're going to need to have a resource in mind, whether it's a contract in place, et cetera, to be prepared to meet those responsibilities. So that is part of the planning scenario that we thought about, and that's the context in which we pursued this. So we found it a very interesting and helpful process. Consequently, it was integral to work we were doing concurrently with our strategic planning process, and I'll talk about that. Hey, Mo, thanks for coming. So I have no disclosures as well. So so we'll talk about the scenarios process and talk about really over the next 2 decades. So we're thinking beyond what many of us often, in ways many of us often think. Think about implications for the health department and understanding this imagination and aspiration. And so if we look at these four scenarios that came out of this, this matched with Clem's graphic. And so the first scenario, there's many gains but disparities grow, actually is within that conventional expectations range of things that he described, sort of the middle of that rainbow. And so that would be number one. As we move into number two, big challenges, public health constrained, we move into that growing desperation stage of public health, the thing that many of us fear. And for those of us I'm more pessimistic, and I have a couple of our folks that tend to comically be pessimistic, they describe this as circling the drain. And so I thought that was a little tough, but the growing desperation scenario. And so moving on to scenario three and four are these higher aspiration scenarios that we're places we all want to be. Really, three and four are riffs on this higher aspiration scenario. And so that's the way that we think about the context of this work.
And let me ask, can everyone hear?
We're good?
Okay, if during either my presentation or Terry's, you're good. Having trouble hearing, just wave.
Great. So what did we do? I should first say that what did we do? We brought together our leadership group, that is our directors and assistants, and we sat down with Clem and Trevor and walked through this process, and them presenting these scenarios out to us and then getting feedback from us on how, reflecting on how it might affect the work that we do into the future over the next two decades. So let's take you through scenario number one. And some of the components of this are built into the model that Glenn presented to us, and we reacted to it to try to put it in context for how it would affect all of us. So for many health gains, but disparities grow, this conventional type, what would be the conventional expectations piece, would be thinking about slow economic growth between 2013 and 2030, financial constraints and instability, fluctuations in public health funding. That's certainly something that we can relate to, something that many of us have dealt with in the past and expect that that fluctuation will continue into the future. Looking at other issues related to climate change, and in this scenario provoking wetter falls in springs, periodic flooding, summer droughts with increasing frequent heat waves. All these are quite plausible. The HIPC piece in the bottom is our health improvement planning process. In this scenario, would remain a force. We've been working on issues around health equity lens, focusing on our priorities in the community and thinking about resilience and sustainability overall in the context of these changes that we'd be dealing with over the next two decades. And what Clem would do is walk through and he'd actually present sort of these, this is what we predict based on the models is going to be happening here within communities that health departments need to take into consideration as they begin to plan out what they would like their preferred future to be based on these four scenarios. So environmental public health in this scenario would focus its activities on resilience, adaptation, and mitigation. We know that, for instance, in Ohio, we're dealing with major algal blooms that are affecting microcystin. Looking at toxic algae problems that are affecting water intake systems and actually shut down the city of Toledo's water system, 500,000 people, for several days. In Lake Erie, a huge body of water, fresh water, dealing with phosphorus, eutrophication because of runoff from farm fields, concerns about combined sewer overflows. As sewers overflow where you have the same pipe with a baffle where stormwater and sewage in older city systems are combined. Major rain events can force, because of lack of infrastructure, force sewage into the lake, adding phosphorus, causing lots of problems. So these are very plausible scenarios that we deal with and challenges that we may face, for instance, around environmental health issues. Promotion of physical activity and healthier foods in schools, including regional farm-to-school initiatives. These are all great things. All of us are working on these healthy eating, active living efforts in communities, looking at sustainability issues, buying more local, community farms, opportunities to move fresh fruits and vegetables into neighborhoods, things that we can all relate to, so that in this scenario, those things continue to happen and are a positive piece in this context. We also see, again, a theme here around emergency preparedness and response activities expanding. We in Cleveland and Akron had the dubious honor of dealing with the second nurse from Texas, that Ebola case that traveled to visit family in Cleveland, which turned into 3 to 4 weeks of lots of work for all of us, responding with quarantining and 163 people that were tracked over the 21-day period, lots of efforts. And so these are planning for emergency response activities and outbreak response that we can't always anticipate, but thinking about the fact that we are in an environment where the emerging infections will continue to be ever present. Also understanding about the idea of increasing analytic capacity around big data sets, hospital systems, public health systems, risk factor surveys, beginning this integration piece, access to meaningful use data from electronic health records, all the things that we know are critical for us, that building that capacity is critical. Food safety challenges persist in this globalization of food sources. We are familiar with challenges often of food that may be either domestic or imported, and exposures that occur, or insults that occur that affect our food supply here in the United States, and recalls are ever present. Thinking about efforts to improve population health and reduce disparities, we know that political polarization is very much of the moment. Ohio is the quintessential swing state. People say we're purple, and I think that as Ohio goes, so has gone the country for many years in terms of the national election. And so for us, that is intuitive. The post-ACA reduction in staff, as we heard certainly Phyllis speak to that, we know that we are in a position of understanding with, for instance, at the Centers for Disease Control funding around the breast and cervical cancer prevention program. As people are sign up, we have Medicaid expansion in Ohio. We're quite grateful for that and hope that that will continue. But as people begin to sign up in the second sign-up period for the ACA, we know that then the care will be provided, a medical home provided, which will affect programs where we gap fill, right around doing case management and screening, treatment opportunities. And we have staff that do that work, so we have to be prepared and understand that we expect there'll be reductions in programs where we are providing case management, where folks will be enrolled and receive the care that we want them to have. What are we going to do with those staff? These are case management folks that perhaps may have another role. Maybe they could help out with the Medicaid population around case management. Can we begin to think about working with our state partners to identify new roles for staff so that we can keep those opportunities available and adapt now as we think about the future? New data tools and sources to decrease infant mortality, teen pregnancy, improve mental health, and reduce violence. These are all things as we think upstream. Work that we're doing in communities around trying to work with and empower youth and create leaders and ambassadors in communities like the city of East Cleveland, right, Mo? And also working on issues around infant mortality. Ohio has the dubious honor of being 50th out of 50 states, highest black-white infant mortality gap in the country in Ohio. Major issue. We need to begin focusing on that, and are focusing on that in 7 urban areas in Ohio, the major cities where most of the births occur. And we understand that violence, looking at violence more directly and mental health, despite some of the issues related to where we are with public health accreditation and as those as core services for public health, as up to date, and certainly in the evolving context, they will very much be front and center for us. Health gains, but health disparities persist, life expectancy as an example. We've been working on a model that Tony Iton from California Endowment, formerly of Alameda County, which is Oakland in California, around looking at life expectancy data and understanding that where you live affects your health and your wealth and your opportunity, and it affects how long you will live. And that we know that if you tell us where your zip code is, we can tell you how long you're going to live. And we know that based on data from our census, from 2000 and 2010, the follow-up data, that we had communities that were just 8 miles apart where we saw a 24-year difference in life expectancy. And there's nothing like data like this going forward over the next 10 to 20 years in this context, about sharing that data with decision makers, and that this will become more prevalent and real-time data will become more of demand from society. And so this is an important way to describe that work. We've often layered over the top of this life expectancy data, fast food locations and big box grocery stores and concentration of vehicles to begin to display these information in a way that means more to policymakers and decision makers. So now we're going to move on to scenario two. And this is the zone of growing desperation. So get out your Kleenex and then we'll move through this briskly here. In this context, in the scenario as it was painted, economic disparities in a cycle of recessions and slow recoveries constrain state and local financing as jobs are lost. Ohio, like everywhere else, suffered in the recession. And this is a plausible scenario. Ohio had a strong industrial complex. Greater Cleveland has a strong industrial complex. And opportunities for jobs are a challenge. Are we able to move into the tech world? We have 20% of our jobs are healthcare. Are there opportunities in tech related to healthcare that are transition points with training for staff? In this case, in this scenario, the losses are seen. Staff are reduced in half. The 2013 number in this scenario, and recurrent and severe recessions. Health reform is largely halted by 2016. What's scary for me is that this, it's hard to know whether this is a scenario or this is a life here. It's certainly many of us, I know, I think I would hope all of us certainly hope that that isn't the case. We can't keep up with the technological advances. We have half the staff, our budget's low. That we know that there's a big gap in have and have-nots with technology as well, and many are uninsured more in the wake of the rollback of the ACA, because then it affects some of the Medicaid expansion provisions, and we see a huge loss all at once of covered individuals and a lack of resources to support them. Climate change overwhelms the nation and the county. 100-year floods a few times each decade. That seems to be happening in many places now. We're dealing with more challenges around climate change, and I think that affects health within the context of major, with frequent events. We hear many communities facing major flooding events in dealing with homes and basements and lots of loss of home equity and costs for cleanup and mold problems and asthma exacerbations and low-income housing because of deferred maintenance and the like. Lots of challenges that can result. So some of these, while they may be zone of desperation, are things that we're already seeing play out in limited context. Scorching summer droughts and extreme weather events. Beaches become unusual and unusable. And new diseases and antibiotic resistance becomes an increasing challenge. And certainly we know that nosocomial infections are a major issue in hospitals now, and we have seen Clostridium difficile certainly move through hospitals across the United States, and the challenges that presents from community-acquired to hospital-acquired infections and back and forth. So these are things that the zone of desperation challenges. And so as these things happen, the value about thinking, other than the concern that we have about this zone of desperation, is what would we do if this was happening to us, and what would we do with reduced staff in half, and how would we handle a situation like this? What are the core things that we could accomplish well, and what would we have to cast off to be useful to the community in the best way that we could? Harsh spending cuts and public dissatisfaction with government severely limit CCBH activities in prevention and emergency preparedness, health improvement implementation, policy advocacy and data collection. And I like this, Clem provided this little box here. It says, due to budget cuts, the light at the end of the tunnel has been turned off. And so we hope that isn't the case. We'll provide some, perhaps in the next scenario, some solar lights to keep that thing running. So moving on, health outcomes and disparities worsen. And I think that this is certainly, when we think about unnatural causes, the work around unnatural causes, and understanding the growing, I think, momentum around dealing with disparities and inequities in a different way, thinking about population health across clinical and community-based care in a very different way this is one that I think many of us, seeing this as our core function, are very fearful of this component of this scenario. So moving on to three, common sense returns and public health wins. Common sense policies of community prevention, injury prevention, living wages, environmental protection are established and broadly supported. So this is something that we know many of us have tried to work toward, this idea of being able to demonstrate that we know we get 4 cents on the dollar of health care from public health, that 75% of the health care dollars are spent on chronic disease, and that we start to see a change in that distribution of dollars based on growing understanding that prevention is the best buy, and that our evidence-based, the chronic disease prevention grants that are out there, the efforts to link hospitals and public health based on the work that's going on with the build grant RFP that's on the street, people begin to build some of those connections to envision a better future and improved evidence base for us to continue work. These are all positive pieces that emerge in this scenario. Climate change policy partisanship decreased. Public policy includes earnest commitments to mitigate climate change. And I would hope that not only that this would just not be an aspirational scenario, that this would be an imperative, certainly, going forward, and that I'm hoping even in the partisan battles that are likely to be part of our reality over the next decade, that this is something where we begin to see a meeting of the minds because of the impact that it will have, the reverberations across the country, particularly on the most vulnerable people that we serve. Redeveloped and mixed-use neighborhoods, complete streets, health and all policies, and local food systems encouraged. I think that we are working in Cuyahoga, as are many counties, around linking together transportation, area coordinating agencies, community development, planning and policy agencies, education, to begin to think about the neighborhood context. And I think that for us in this scenario, much of the work we're doing now that is done on a pilot basis would be taken to scale, particularly in areas that where we know within the core city of Cleveland and the first ring suburbs where we see most of the decline, the gaps as it may relate to lower educational attainment and higher rates of poverty, that we start to see efforts placed in those areas so that we can try to create some reduce inequalities and create some equality of opportunity. Technology and digital divides are reduced. Environmental sensing, biomonitoring, and smartphone use become ubiquitous and inexpensive. In this scenario, the algal blooms that I described to you are mitigated. So what's happening right now is we know that phosphorus, because of these combined sewer overflows, is a problem. We start to see green infrastructure implemented, and some of that is beginning to happen now. Interceptors to hold back storm water that's combined with sewage on rain events so that it can be treated at a later time after the rain event. We start to see reductions in other parts of Ohio where manure is placed on farm fields in the winter and runs off into rivers and then into the lake, where dredgings, which are replete with phosphorus, aren't open dumped into lake systems and increasing phosphorus. We see that laws are put in place to capture and contain that waste so that it doesn't affect the water supply. We see efforts to monitor beach water quality and improvement in lake water quality because of the monitoring and real-time data available to residents. And also people begin to use the data, as we are already seeing now, other than a few early adopters, to using data around monitoring steps, health outcomes, and key metrics, so they're able to take charge of their own health and then connecting remotely. This idea that Clint talks about, that digital avatars that he can explain to us later. I think about these as the holograms, sort of a hologram doc that would be available to assist in even some of the telemedicine work that's already happening. Culture of greater equity, collaborative consumption, reuse, and crowdsourcing encourage inter- and intra-community improvement, resilience, and cooperation. So I think many things that we know are already happening with the younger generation that may be quite intuitive in terms of how people link together and begin to address problems in this scenario become the rule rather than the exception. And I think we often know that in the work we do around health improvement planning, once we can often take grants that are fleeting and we build that capacity in a neighborhood or a community, that that's more likely to sustain it and involve them from an engagement standpoint in the beginning, that we're more likely to be successful. And so for us, we can think about what we need to do as in each one of these steps to realize this preferred future, and what we can do to support from the public health context these moving things in this direction. Healthcare reform succeeds, and accountable care organizations promote population health. We start to think more of the context of accountable care communities. Can we build around the community benefit issues that hospitals, nonprofit hospitals, are working on to look at how those community benefit dollars are allocated? Can we build community health assessments, conduct community health assessments, and build community health improvement plans together with hospital systems? Or perhaps with a hospital association. And in Cleveland, we'd rather do it with the hospital association because we have 27 hospitals that we'd be dealing with that are in a five-county area. Can we do one assessment? It's the best use of dollars. Can we then in that one assessment choose some things that are common to work on together between public health and medicine? And I would add United Way, for instance, in that scenario, who has their own improvement planning processes. How can we unite those pieces? In this scenario, we do a better use of resources, more meaningful and long-lasting work, and better outcomes. Health outcomes among Medicaid recipients markedly improve. In this scenario, obviously, the ACA is strong. Medicaid expansion continues. We see the outcomes we all hope for, reducing late-stage cancer diagnosis and consequently mortality, reducing disparities in diabetes. We see lower rates of smoking among Medicaid populations, all the positive indicators that we all hope for. And that is a reduced cost to the system, improve the economy, lots of benefits. And so what it helped us to do was to think about, if this happens, what are the reverberating benefits? Or from the number two scenario, what are the reverberating detriments that we need to understand, and how do we think about those? CCBH served as chief health strategist, which is a term that I think for public health is an aspirational one that I think we should all think about, is how can we position ourselves to be the chief health strategist in the community around health improvement planning, around data analysis and communication to the public, and perhaps as Switzerland in some of these situations among competing hospital systems and groups. How can we be, you know, how can we fly that flag and be the neutral, trusted strategist? Mapping, monitoring social media, health and all policies, and we all figure out how to go viral in a positive way based on our messaging and our astuteness in using social media. Which is certainly for all of us, in most cases, still something in its infancy. More financially stable and a smaller staff, but a more financially stable staff in this scenario. Moving on to scenario four. My code is your code. Major recession in 2017 in the model Clem would provide these injects that help us. We think all of a sudden, boom, there's a recession in 2017, so it's a new piece of information for us to think about. Increases visibility of disparities and engaging advocacy leads to the My Code is Your Code movement. And I think the next slide gets into this a little bit, is that My Code is Your Code uses technology, citizen science, and with this Netizen and advocacy to conduct social coding and social programming to reflect code of fairness and to eliminate disparities and marginalization that result from inherent differences in genetic codes and zip codes. So I think that this is an understanding that we all do better when we all do better, right? That we understand that there may be genetic differences and predispositions that can disproportionately affect populations around health outcomes, and that we begin to think about the importance of the neighborhood context And we know that in there are children, for instance, a city just outside of the city of Cleveland called the city of East Cleveland, which is in the shadow of large medical systems and major universities and businesses, that there are children there that live 5 miles from Lake Erie that have never seen it because of their isolation in neighborhoods. And thinking about that isolation context, what can we do about creating the conditions? And in this case, we're working in terms of mitigating these differences to create the conditions in which they can be healthy in those neighborhoods. And I think we start to see an understanding of this value and those differences and inequities as being detrimental to the prosperity of the region. Alternative economics activities and technologies that are adapted and improve community health, resilience, and solidarity. We start to see a lot of these pieces around communities being given the freedom around zoning, interaction, and support to think differently about providing for their citizens and for each other. A lot more impact on decision-making in communities, the engagement of communities before and citizens before projects are done becomes more of the norm rather than some perhaps fleeting or after-the-fact engagement after the job has already been set and underway. Healthcare reform continued, and ACOs evolved into accountable care communities. So this is something that we all certainly hope for, that we see that we are linked seamlessly with healthcare. We envision a situation where a child who has asthma, who might have frequent visits to the emergency room because of a number of compounding disadvantages that they face, that referral then results in a prescription for a home visit for by an environmental public health and nurse team that's identifying triggers, assuring fidelity to the care plan, taking home environment assessments that is then fed back to the primary care doc so they're made aware of what may be present in terms of triggers, and that then works to improve, reduce exacerbations, reduce school absenteeism. We begin to think about this as one scenario and one example of how this harmonization begins to have positive impacts on health outcomes, particularly for those that have been marginalized. And it also has a net impact on economic development, on educational attainment, performance, and kids meeting their full expectations. So we're a strong ally and leader in climate and health goals and initiatives, including environmental mitigation and renewable energy. Believe it or not, there's talk already in Lake Erie of putting up these wind farms. Some people don't like it because they think it'll be an eyesore. But be that as it may, I think that this work is going forward as a way, I think, at this point in early stages as just a demonstration project. But realizing the lake and the water quality in Lake Erie is a huge asset for the region, recreationally, tourism, a range of obvious benefits. But that we start understanding that in the context of climate and health goals, that it's embraced in this scenario. Strong partnerships and collaborations with My Code is Your Code, citizens, scientists, group nets, accountable care communities, government agencies, and businesses improve sustainability, health, and health equity. So we start to really see, again, more of the same, a link around a range of agencies. And someone said yesterday something that was interesting. When we talk about, you know, health in all policies, that some people see that as a bit of an imperious way of doing business, that health is first, that it's not about transportation, it's really about health. I think that we talk about looking with a sort of a health lens at some of these other sectors, because they may be thinking about light rail and mixed use in communities and redevelopment and access to grocery stores as a community asset, not from a health context, but if the net benefit in these redesigns improves health, then we perhaps need to be in a position of advocating for what they're trying to get done, because the net benefit will be good for health. So this is just a different sort of context I heard yesterday that I thought was relevant as we begin to approach non-traditional partners and communities and identify that we're all working toward better health, toward mitigating the effects of poverty, toward improving education, and toward better economies and opportunity. So this is the comparative scenario matrix that Clem put together. This comparison across these scenarios and looking at these operating environments we see around economic issues, climate, water, flooding events, information communication systems and technology, healthcare, and then also within the context of the health department and the departments within the agency and funding sources and staffing. And so what happened in this design is we looked at these four scenarios, and this was an interesting exercise. We did it both with the experts, mm-hmm. and we did it with our department, and I'm sure that all the other departments, Fargo and Boston and mm-hmm. Virginia, they all did the same thing. And so we look in the first column there, what is the likelihood from 0 to 100% that each one of these scenarios did people think it would occur? And this is our management group that went through this process. So then the second column is what's more preferred. That is, what would that group collectively prefer would happen? And so here is our data. Since it's all public record, you have it now. It's out here. And so what you'll see here is that in this particular scenario, the likelihood people felt was that number one, which was, you'll recall, number one was the title and the description was that would be conventional expectations. That was the one that scored highest among the group. They felt that conventional expectations was the most likely in their mind that scenario. But of course, the preferred ones, as you'd expect, were 3 and 4 by staff. Now, if we did this today, a number of things that have happened in recently here around reimagining our role with Medicaid in Ohio for public health, that's sort of new, emerging issue, opportunities from chronic disease funding that we received REACH funding through the chronic disease grants from CDC, Medicaid expansion likely. A range of these things would affect perhaps the way everyone was feeling in the room that day. But at the same time, I don't know that we might see these numbers change a bit on the likelihood scenario, but I think the preferability would probably be near the same. Yes, sir?
Remind us again who your respondents were. I'm a little surprised to see that 5 selected scenario 2 is...
So this is 52.14%, right? That's the percent.
Yeah,
right?
that is...
I'm sorry, I'm
It's the mean and median are the scores. So it's not 5 people. It is the mean and the median. So that there were some preferability votes put against 2, and that we find that tends to happen. It's usually in the 2 or 3 to 10 range, and this was the case.
Okay. So in terms of results, these are questions of the group that Clem posed. And so among the question here was, what did you learn from your involvement in the scenarios process? These are some excerpts. Were there any new or surprising insights? Helped our leadership team to think more in the long term, identifying emerging challenges and opportunities that inform our strategic planning process. I think that it was nice to take some time to think about this, because we're all so busy in the moment that we often don't take the time to think about what we might like to see and how we think we might get there beyond the traditional sort of 3 to 5 year planning phases. Help to envision the most desirable future and begin to plan for the strategic investments to get there. And so, as I mentioned, we're amidst a strategic planning process in our agency. And so the timing on this is good in terms of understanding some of these predictors and we're finding that some of the things, for instance, around IT capacity are things that we're hearing from staff as a need that we need to, as an issue we need to bolster into the future, and actually are echoed in a number of data sources and ways that we've tried to collect information for thinking about our planning process. Commonalities across the public health enterprise. I would venture to say that all of you, or most of you, could see your departments and pieces of what you do in here, or how these issues might affect the work that you do. And as the enterprise changes in the wake of the ACA, in the changing context of what we do, I think this makes this sort of work even more pressing. That we are, I do believe that that the amount of change and the rapidity of the nature of the evolution that we're seeing, hospital mergers and acquisitions, perhaps overtures into community health in ways that hospitals hadn't traditionally done the work, that all these pieces are changing the entire enterprise, and we've got to be nimble. And I think some of the work that Phyllis mentioned, their interest is meant to help us to think ahead in that futuristic context about how to prepare for those realities. In what ways may your takeaways from the scenarios process affect how you monitor the environment? Participants noted that internal staff will be encouraged to broaden the scope of external monitoring engagement, community engagement, and that they will pay closer attention to advances in information technology, and it validated the future investments in informatics and big data analytic capacity that we know need to be made now in order to be a player in that context going forward. We're doing community engagement quite extensively in our health improvement planning process, but we know that this is that broadening it is going to be essential going forward, as projects are planned in a very meaningful and authentic way, that needs to be part of how we approach our work internally and externally. In what ways may your takeaways from the scenario affect strategies or tactics that we use? So we have an internal strength, weaknesses, opportunities, and challenges analysis. It certainly matched up with that in terms of our development of our health improvement plan and our strategic plan, and encourages more team approaches, both vertical and horizontal team approaches within the agency and among community partners to plan for opportunities created by expansion of the Affordable Care Act that we believe is the case. Or, conversely, should we see the ACA basically be halted? I think would require the same sort of approach. How would it affect your communications and relationship with partners? We believe we have strong relationships, but that we need to increase the types of partnerships that we have and the players that we work with, different players. We're already doing that now around planning, around trails, and work we're doing around health impact assessment, looking at walkability, bikeability on main thoroughfares, and who our partners are and how they see public health being useful to the work that they do, and expanding those networks. And so with that, we have these scenarios available here, where you can find all of these scenarios from both ours and as well as the other departments are available through CLEM's website.
Okay, thank you.